Leaning Toward Wisdom, episode 4010. Hey, welcome inside the Yellow Studio, kids. My name is Randy Cantrell, your host here at Leaning Toward Wisdom. Today, three tips to create a process toward your own greatness. Episode 4010. You can find the show notes over at leaningtowardwisdom.com. Just search for episode 4010. We'll do it next. How's January wrapping up for you? Good, I hope. A month is already gone. Hard to believe, isn't it? Well, it's just about gone. Almost. Three tips to create a process towards your own greatness. I had this episode title, and I've played around with it. I need to work on my headline writing. I probably don't give it near the attention that it deserves. I had originally titled it, Why Good Is Not the Enemy of Great. Good is the enemy of great is a quote. In fact, it's how Jim Collins begins his classic business bestseller, Good to Great, Why Some Companies Make the Leap and Others Don't. Yeah, that's how the book starts. Good is the enemy of great. Now, in all fairness, Mr. Collins argues the veracity of that sentence because people settle for good and they stop pursuing better. Yeah, you know what that leaves us with. Yeah, it leaves us with good, but not great outcomes. So that's what we want to talk about today. Welcome inside the Yellow Studio. Leaning Toward Wisdom, as we said, is the podcast. And hey, we're back in iTunes, kids. So you can go over to the website and you will see links there where you can subscribe to the podcast via iTunes. All of the episodes now start with 4,000 series numbers because not because there are 4,000 episodes, but because this is the fourth iteration. And I'm willing to admit it, the fourth iteration of Leaning Toward Wisdom. And I don't mind. It's perfectly cool with me. I got that if you're a podcaster, you know this message. Well, you've likely encountered this message when you submit a feed to iTunes and they say, this feed's already been submitted. And you're like, yeah, okay, but it's not there. The podcast used to be on iTunes, and there are a lot of iTunes podcasts that have been dormant for a long, long time, and they're still showing up in the iTunes podcast directory. For some reason, unbeknownst to me, this one dropped off, and then I couldn't submit it. And you see all kinds of support tickets where people go, oh, man, the Apple people, they're not helpful. I had just the opposite experience. They were very helpful. I got bumped up to a supervisor who then, you know, pushed it over to engineering and presto change-o. Got the feed in there and we're good to go. So I hope that helps you. Made the submission to Stitcher, so hopefully that'll be coming up shortly. All right. Good is the enemy of great. Is it? Is it really? Let me talk to you about the value of the process on the mountain. Now, I'm living here in North Central Texas, and yeah, we don't have mountains. But I want to tell you about the value of the process on the mountain. Michaela Schifrin is an 18-year-old World Cup champion slalom skier. She was the subject, well, she is the subject, of this month's 60-Minute Sports on Showtime. Born in Vail, Colorado, and her parents, by the way, they're both very accomplished skiers, Ms. Schifrin attended the Burke Mountain Academy in Vermont. Now, am I the only one that just seems odd? I mean, you're in Vail, Colorado, and you go to Vermont to a ski school? Yeah, she did, because skiing conditions in Vermont more closely resemble the European ski circuit. Well, how's that possible? Now, I'm not a ski expert. I'm certainly not a snow expert. Again, I told you I'm in Dallas, Fort Worth, Texas. So Yeah, okay, we get snow. A couple of years ago, we got 14 inches of snow, shut down DFW International Airport for the first time in its history. But that's not typical for us. Well, the European ski circuit is evidently pretty icy. And those same kind of conditions exist in Vermont. They do not exist in Vail, Colorado. And it obviously has worked because this school has produced 30 Olympians since its inception in the early 1970s. Now, the Schifrins, they sent their daughter to Vermont for training, not because they are living vicariously through their talented daughter, but because she is a driven young woman. She is committed to become world class. And she clearly has championship stuff, as evidenced by her recent World Cup championship runs. Michaela is the youngest slalom world champion in U.S. history. And that includes men and women. They showed some video where the parents put her on these little plastic skis when she was just, you know, a couple of years old. And I mean, you could tell the girl just loved it. Jeff Schifrin, her father, he told 60 Minute Sports that he and his wife, Eileen, they weren't trying to produce a pro athlete. They simply wanted her to learn, as he put it, the process. And so Mr. Schifrin talked very candidly about the dance with the mountain. That's what he called it. And he made an observation that when you ski a good run that has, you know, five good turns in it, you immediately come down the mountain and you say, that was fun. I want to do that again. And so her parents concentrated on that dance with the mountain, all the while ensuring that she would have fun learning the process. Her father continued to pound that point home. Learning the process. The international skiing community, they marvel at Michaela's focus. Her focus, especially given how young she is. But, you know, when you understand how her parents and her coaches have helped her, it's pretty apparent that they understood the value of repeating good habits. She wanted to be great, so her supporters did everything possible to give her a process that would deliver consistently good results. And that's why, by the way, they recommended that she delay her competition. On December 14th, 2010, Michaela won her first race. She was 15 years old, and it was only her eighth International Ski Federation race ever. Well, other skiers, they were busy competing. Not Michaela. No, she was still in Vermont training. Her coaches at the Burke Mountain Academy, they knew that a full day of competition would result in two ski runs a day, while a full day of training there in Vermont would result in 15 good ski runs a day over a prolonged period of time gave Michaela the foundation to become a great world-class competitor. Burke Mountain Academy, by the way, they've got this old-style ski lift, and it's not because they're cheap and chintzy. It's by design. It's an old-style lift where skiers straddle a single seat, and they just stay on their skis. And this cable pulls them back up to the top of the mountain on their skis, but they're seated on this little round seat, and it's hanging by a cable, but their skis never leave the ground. And so those riding the cable back to the top, man, they're just feet away from the course. And so as they're riding back up to the top of the mountain, they are watching the other students, the other skiers, navigate the gates of the slalom course. During a full day of training, these skiers, they're never off their skis. I mean, even when they're being pulled back to the top. And so skiers sit in quiet, solitary reflection on this ride back to the top of the mountain. No cell phones, no conversation with other friends, because each student is alone. It's not like the ski lifts that you see where, you know, two or three people are sitting side by side and their feet are dangling in the air. No, no. Each student here, they're alone with their thoughts as they watch other students ski down the course. The coaches credit the process of that ski lift with providing students good focus training. Now, Michaela, admittedly, she is a training junkie, and she is known to spend up to 5 hours a day in the gym when she's not on the mountain. And this young lady is committed. Well, listen, here's a quote that I found. Here's one thing that she said. When I was a J5, I did a lot of free skiing. I don't know what a J5 is, but when I was a J5, I did a lot of free skiing, and I actually didn't like free skiing. I just thought it was a waste of time, and I would have rather been training or directed free skiing. I always wanted to be thinking of something, whether it was arms forward or my parents had a saying, knees to skis and hands in front. It's been drilled into my head, and every time I get on the snow, that's what I start thinking. I did free ski a lot. I did do a lot of drills. It was probably a third free skiing, a third drills, a third gates. And I did a lot of mogul skiing. I love skiing the bumps, just the rhythm. Trying not to eat it on a bump was really fun for me. She wanted to be thinking of something. I would have rather been training, she said. Well, by the time she had devoted herself to years of practice runs, hours in the gym, and all kinds of other coaching and training, she was prepared to be great. And none of it would have been possible without what her father calls the process. Let me talk to you about the value of the process on the gridiron. University of Alabama football coach Nick Saban is a man who constantly talks about the process. Saban brought an NCAA championship to LSU in 2003. He coached the Crimson Tide to three national championships in 2009, in 2011, and 2012. He's the first coach in college football history to win a national title with two different FBS, that's football bowl subdivision schools. I mean, the man knows how to coach football. Born in West Virginia, Saban learned the value of hard work as a boy. This guy is a serious competitor. He openly speaks about enjoying the process. And he expects all of his players, by the way, to devote themselves fully to the process. That means lots of time in the gym, lots of time in the film room, lots of time on the practice field. But it's more than time. It's doing things right. He expects every drill, he expects every play to be done with 100% accuracy. I mean, he's fastidious. He's a detail freak. Mostly, he preaches for his players to trust the process. In a GQ article last September, a fellow coach made this observation about Saban. Quote, "The thing that amazes me about him is that he doesn't let up," says retired Florida State coach Bobby Bowden. "People start winning, they slack off. But he just keeps jumping on complacency, complacency, complacency. Most coaches don't think like that." Saban believes so strongly in the process that he will not allow himself, he won't allow his staffers, players, to settle because good isn't good enough. Again, from the GQ article, quoting, "Saban's guiding vision is something he calls the process, a philosophy that emphasizes preparation and hard work over consideration of outcomes or results." Yeah, let me repeat that because this is really critical. Saban's guiding vision is something he calls the process, a philosophy that emphasizes preparation and hard work over consideration of outcomes or results. Barrett Jones, an offensive lineman on all three of Saban's national championship teams at Alabama and now a rookie with the St. Louis Rams, explains the process this way. "It's not what you do. It's how you do it." Well, let me talk to you about the value of the process when it comes to consistent details, because that really is the value of the process. It's all in the consistency of the details. Coach John Wooden, famed coach of UCLA Bruins basketball, he said, it's the little details that are vital. Little things make big things happen. Well, you're not likely a World Cup skier or an NCAA Division I head football coach, but the value of the process or the value of process is still very beneficial to you. Details are important, and they are a critical part of the process. You know, that innocuous ski lift that I described that played a vital role in helping Michaela Schifrin learn how to focus, her coach pointed out that at least three benefits exist to that one seemingly minor detail. I mean, who's gonna tout, hey, come to our ski school because we've got this old-fashioned ski lift? Nobody. Well, okay, nobody except Berg Mountain. Here's what the coach said. Number one value of that ski lift, solitude. The skiers are alone in their thoughts. And by going up the mountain alone, the skiers are not able to engage in chit-chat with each other. Number two, nearness to the course. This proximity to the course and watching other students ski that course as you ride back up to the top of the mountain has an incredible value, because watching other students maneuver that course teaches the students coming up how to make a better run the next time. Three, by remaining on their skis, the students aren't able to use cell phones or do anything else except remain on their skis, focused on successfully making it back to the starting line. Now, does that just not seem like an incredibly small detail with ridiculously high payoff? It's an old-fashioned ski lift. And look at what it accomplishes. It accomplishes big things for the students. And you can't argue with the process of a ski school that has produced over 130 U.S. ski team members and 30 Olympians. Well, you can try, but you'd fail in arguing against it. Don't tell headmaster Kirk Dwyer that details don't matter. And don't tell him that a good process can't produce greatness. Now, meanwhile, in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, home to the University of Alabama, part of Coach Saban's process has a name. His name is Scott Cochran. He is director of strength and conditioning, and he is this crazed Cajun from New Orleans who first joined Saban at LSU. He's an LSU grad. NCAA rules are very strict, and they limit the exposure that coaches can have with players. And so enter the detail of a process, which is part of Scott's role. Spring drills and off-season conditioning, yeah, that's all Scott Cochran's domain. In fact, it's such an important part of the Alabama football program that it has a name. Fourth quarter program. Fourth quarter program. Alabama players are notorious for maintaining strength through all four quarters of a football game. Now, meanwhile, opposing players, they wear down during the game, but Alabama's attention to the process prepares them to press on until the game is over. You need proof that that works? Okay, no problem. In their 2009 championship season, they outscored their opponent in the fourth quarter 121-32. 121-32. In 2011, another national championship season, they outscored their opponents 111-18. Three things. Three things that can help you craft a process towards your own greatness. Now, instead of relying on luck or random chance, you ought to consider developing your own process. Don't shy away from doing consistently good work or doing as good as you can. I know a lot of people poo-poo that, and it's just a mistake. this is really where I wanted to kind of name this thing. You know, good is not the enemy of great, because you can't get to be great until you're first good. So embrace it. Alan Williams was the booking agent who booked the Beatles in Hamburg, Germany in August of 1960. He was not impressed with them. In fact, he planned to replace them. He was hoping he'd get a better act because they weren't yet great. I mean, it was suspicious if they would even be good enough to hang with the best acts of Hamburg. But what did they do? Well, they did the arduous work of grinding it out. It was part of their process, and it was required so that they could be prepared for America and what would eventually be international fame. They were in Hamburg from August of 1960 to December of 1962. In the anthology of the Beatles, John Lennon is quoted as saying, "We had to play for hours and hours on end. Every song lasted 20 minutes and had 20 solos in it. That's what improved the playing. There was nobody to copy from. We played what we liked best, and the Germans liked it, as long as it was loud." Now think about this. The Beatles were not even the best band in Hamburg, Germany at the time. In fact, Williams told them the competition was fierce. And he warned them. He warned them to watch out for the 900-pound gorilla band in Hamburg, Germany. "Oh, it's that famous band. You know who they are." No, you don't. Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. Here's what Williams told the band. Quote, "You'd better pull your socks up because Rory Storm and the Hurricanes are coming in, and you know how good they are. They're going to knock you for six." I don't know what happened to Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. Okay, maybe they didn't have the talent, but I can tell you this, it's not very likely that they stuck to the process. Meanwhile, the Beatles were busy developing a process, sticking with the process, and digging in to do the work. And in fact, for over 2 years, they appeared to languish in this nasty, awful, deplorable conditions, not just playing conditions, but living conditions. But you know what? There is no doubt that without Hamburg, Germany, the Beatles may have never been ready for America and worldwide fame. Why? Because Hamburg, Germany was their process. Here are some things that you can do to develop your process. I'm going to give you three of them. Number one, take the time to devise the next step. You remember what I said about not focusing on the outcome? You know, Saban is so intent in coaching his football team. Michaela Schifrin was so intent, and her coaches and her parents were so intent on embracing the process, having fun with the process. Don't get ahead of yourself. Don't focus on the outcome yet, because greatness isn't often the result of intense focus on the result, but on the process. And so Michaela is making 15 ski runs a day while other girls are on a European circuit making 2 runs a day. Why? Well, they were focused on competing. She was concentrating on her process. What's the very next thing that you can do to move forward? I mean, the Beatles, they didn't go from bad to great. First, they had to get good enough to entertain those tough crowds of Hamburg. What do you have to do to get good? I mean, come on. The Beatles weren't better than Rory Storm and the Hurricanes at some point, and we've never heard of Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. What do you have to do to get good? This step is likely going to involve lots of hard work. Don't discount repetition. Howard K. Smith was a national news anchor for ABC News in the late 60s through about the mid-1970s, and I once heard him say in an interview, speaking about training his young children at the time to be good communicators. He said every day he had them write down one clear sentence every day. That daily devotion to something so simple that may have resulted in helping his son Jack become an award-winning journalist before he died at the age of, well, he was 58, almost 59. He died of pancreatic cancer. But think of the impact of having your children, your school-age children, write one clear sentence every day. I mean, that, what is that? I can tell you what that is. It's the process. Don't complicate it. Don't overthink it. Just figure out the next step and start doing it consistently. Because then you can figure out, now what's next? Number two, do what others aren't willing to do. Alabama football players, well, they're willing to spend time in the gym while opponents are doing something else. Scott Cochran is running the team. He's cheerleading their weight room training. He is pushing them harder while the opponents are probably calling it a day. Michaela Schifrin was staying on that practice mountain in Vermont while other girls were in Europe competing. She was in the gym doing a lot of weight training while others were figuring they'd done enough already. If you want to be great, you must be willing to do more, to go further, and to endure more than other people. You can't be good unless you're willing to be above average. Listen, if everybody were good, well, then good would only be average. But as Sturgeon's Revelation says, quoted from Venture Magazine, March 1958, by Theodore Sturgeon, an American sci-fi author and critic, quote, "I repeat Sturgeon's revelation, which was wrung out of me after 20 years of wearying defense of science fiction against attacks of people who use the worst examples of the field for ammunition and whose conclusion was that 90% of science fiction is crud. Using the same standards that categorize 90% of science fiction as trash, crud, or crap, it can be argued that 90% of film, literature, consumer goods, etc., are crap. In other words, the claim or fact that 90% of science fiction is crap is ultimately uninformative because science fiction conforms to the same trends of quality as all other art forms." I mean, is that a good quote or what? And you know, Mr. Sturgeon was surely on to something. Because 90% of everything is crap. And that means that you're going to have to work really hard to unearth the things, the process, that will get you above the herd, above the crap level. And if you don't, you're going to end up as part of that 90%. The Beatles were willing to leave home. They were just boys. They were kids. They were like 17. In fact, the promoter had to, you know, he had to talk their parents into letting them go. I mean, they deceived them that, oh, no, it's safe. It's going to be, you know, and it was just it was squalor. It was a place that was littered with prostitution and drug abuse. And they lived in that squalor for over 2 years, and they were just kids. How many other kids were willing to go and make that sacrifice? Yeah, they had talent. I'm not discounting talent, but you and I both know, we know of a lot of musicians and bands that have marvelous talent and nobody knows them. And sometimes we marvel at how good they are and we're like, you know, how come they've never made it? Well, I don't know. But I know this, we've all heard the adage, the harder I practice, the luckier I get. Be willing to do the hard practice that others aren't willing to do. Tip number three, slow and steady compound your results. Be patient. Did you take an economics class in college? If you did, then you probably are like me and you had a professor who asked the class, would you rather have a penny doubled every day for 30 days or $1 million cash. And if you're like all the rest of us, hey, give me the cash. Give me the $1 million cash. And the point of the question was to teach us the power of compounding. Double a penny every day for 30 days. And after a month, after 30 days, you will have $5,368,709.12. Yeah. $5,368,709.12 in a month. Over five times the $1 million you would have settled for if you'd have said, give me the million. And I know what you're thinking, the same thing that we always thought. It's just a penny. No, it's a penny doubled every day. When you grind out the process, the results pile up, and they keep piling up, and they compound, and they keep on compounding. As Malcolm Gladwell points out in The Tipping Point, there is this critical time when things, they seem to turn. If you look at the doubling of a penny every day, you will not reach the $1,000 mark until day 18. Come on, you've only got 30 days. You kidding me? It takes me 18 days to get to a grand? Over 2 weeks and I haven't busted a grand yet? Yeah. Well, that can be discouraging. No doubt. But if you hang tough, by day 21, that's just 3 days later. 3 days later, not only have you busted 1,000, you've busted 10,000. And then on day 22, just 1 day later, you've doubled it. Remember, we're doubling it every day. And now on day 22, you're over 20 grand. If you quit now, you've only got 8 days left. And with only 8 days left, you can quit. But you know what? You'd miss out on 99.61% of the total gain. You'd miss it all. You'd leave $5,347,737.60 on the table. You'd leave that much behind if you quit too soon, because you're looking at day 22 and thinking, man alive, I got 20 grand. I could have had $1 million cash up front. You'd quit too soon because really all you've gained is 0.39% of your total results in the first 18 days. It took you 18 days to get to 0.39% of the total. Yeah, greatness takes time. So don't quit too soon. Okay, well, what's the conclusion of all this? My son is a pretty good hockey player, you know, for an amateur. He was a little boy when we first put him on skates. He was frustrated as all get out. He was angry. He wanted to quit because he was wired that, you know, if he couldn't master it right out of the gate, then what's the point? But my wife in particular, she pressed him to hang with it. And simply because he couldn't master it right off the bat, like so many other things, including pogo sticks, he just wanted to quit. We encouraged him by convincing him nobody can be accomplished when they start. And so he fell. He fell often, and then he fell less often. And at first he hung on to people and he hung on to things. But he kept at it until he didn't need to hang on to anybody and he didn't need to hang on to anything. And he continued to skate and he continued to skate and he continued to skate. And pretty soon he and his sister, anytime we went to the skating rink, well, they were always the fastest, best skaters. By the time he was 11, well, he was as comfortable on skates as he was in sneakers. Today, he's 33. And I doubt he can remember a time when he couldn't skate. Everything is hard until it's easy. The key to success is to grind it out, and it's to grind out the hard part until it gets easy. And that's best done when you can embrace and love the process without too much focus on the outcome. And so enjoy those practice runs. Enjoy the weight room. Enjoy that spring training. And then when it counts, you're going to realize that you have paid the price for greatness. Yeah, that's how it works. Subscribe to the podcast. I told you how to do that. Come on, go over to iTunes. Hey, man, you can help me out too. I'd love it if you'd leave a review over there. I mean, what are we up to? 10 episodes? 10 episodes. I'm going to start getting consistent with it now that I'm back in iTunes. I've just kind of been waiting till I got that approval. And hopefully, like I said, here any day now, we'll get back into Stitcher. We'll get into Stitcher. The website is leaningtowardwisdom.com. This was episode 4010. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you got something out of it. I hope it inspires you to create your own process and embrace the process without consideration of the outcome or the results. Just figure out a process that you can love and move forward. All kinds of social icons are over at the website, all kind of ways that you can connect with me and reach out to me. I'd love to hear from you. So reach me through Facebook or Twitter or Pinterest. Got a YouTube channel. I need to put something over there. I haven't done anything new in YouTube in a long time, so I need to get on that. Lots of things I need to get on to. Probably like you, right? New year. We don't need to languish now. We don't need to waste time. So get busy. Get busy. Hey, join the community, an exclusive monthly newsletter. Just plug in your email address over there on the right-hand side of the website, and I'll make sure to get you in, and I'll send you the info. And again, it's monthly, so you don't have to worry about a whole lot of emails coming from me. LeaningTowardWisdom.com is the website. My name is Randy Cantrell. City of origin is Dallas, Fort Worth, Texas. This is the Yellow Studio.